What does it feel like when your soul is being torn from your body, when every cell screams for relief that you know will destroy you? David Poses opens his story not with the glamour of drug use, but with its brutal opposite, withdrawal. Confined to his mother's house, he scrapes residue from old heroin bags with the desperation of someone drowning. 6 Clonopin barely touch the agony. His friend Rob suggests methadone, a slow taper, anything reasonable. David refuses. He's convinced he can white-knuckle his way through this nightmare alone. Then his father arrives with strangers who physically restrain him, dragging him to a hospital where his addictions are announced to a room full of clinical faces. They call it tough love, but there's nothing loving about being treated like a criminal for suffering you didn't choose. This forced intervention strips away dignity and agency, the very things that prove essential to genuine recovery. The scene establishes a question that haunts the entire narrative. Can healing happen when it's imposed rather than chosen? As David is hauled away, the irony becomes clear. A system designed to help often begins by inflicting its own trauma. At Hazelden, a renowned Minnesota facility, David arrives deeply skeptical. During a heated exchange with Counselor Ron, he challenges the foundation. "You're telling me I'm powerless when what I need most is power over my own life?" This resistance positions him as an outsider among peers who've embraced recovery. In group therapy, he hears stories of reckless abandon, trauma, and near-death experiences. Each person's rock bottom looks different, but the common thread is pain. Pain they tried to escape, pain they caused others, pain that seemed inescapable without chemical relief. These stories chip away at David's detachment, forcing him to recognize shared suffering. Sessions with Counselor Nancy uncover connections between his past and present confusion. Yet the program's insistence that addiction is a disease, separate from his depression, misses the point entirely. For David, heroin wasn't about chasing euphoria. It was about relief. The first time he used, the crushing weight on his chest lifted. The constant noise quieted. He could finally breathe. Traditional treatment addresses the symptom while ignoring the underlying disease, setting the stage for inevitable failure. Weekend visits bring David's father to rehab like a hurricane full of judgment and exaggerated tales of his son's misdeeds. In his version, David is nothing but his worst moments strung together without context or compassion. Their interaction culminates in a stark ultimatum: achieve sobriety under his father's terms or face abandonment. Yet family holds both wounds and healing. Later, driving through Brooklyn with his mother searching for furniture, she offers rare affirmation. "Sometimes I think you're just like your grandfather. He had that same restless creativity, that same hunger to make something meaningful." His grandfather, Ralph, struggled with morphine in the 1950s, a ghostly parallel suggesting addiction's complex dance with genetics and environment. Addiction fractures trust across generations. Years later, David maintains the facade of sobriety with his brother despite ongoing struggles. Family relationships become both the source of inherited trauma and the potential path toward healing, if only honesty can break through the layers of shame and silence. With Christine at Marlborough College, David discovers intellectual intimacy through shared books that briefly eclipses his cravings. After infidelity destroys his relationship with Jane, Andrea enters his life. They exchange perspectives on paintings, collaborate on creative projects, build a life that seems to transcend his troubled past. Yet addiction's shadow lurks beneath these genuine connections. David's inability to be fully honest creates invisible barriers. He masters compartmentalization. 9-to-5 David wears button-downs and pitches ideas in meetings. After hours, David calculates exactly how many pills he needs to avoid withdrawal without appearing high. The exhausting mental arithmetic of money, dosage, and timing consumes thoughts that should belong to the people he loves. Art becomes both salvation and symptom. Cinema offers therapeutic refuge, creative writing provides expression. But these same impulses sometimes justify drug use, which David frames as accessing deeper artistic truths. I convinced myself that heroin was my creative fuel, he admits. It was the perfect lie. It made destruction seem like creation. Until he can integrate all aspects of himself, the artist, the lover, the addict, the depressive, lasting healing remains impossibly out of reach. The memoir's most unsettling revelation is how addiction coexists with external success. David secures advertising work, moves to Brooklyn, buys a home, marries, and becomes a father, all while spiraling deeper into dependency. Grant, an inconspicuous Wall Street analyst who moonlights as a dealer, symbolizes how addiction crosses all social boundaries. This double life demands elaborate deceptions. Morning use evolves from pleasure-seeking to survival. It wasn't about getting high anymore. It was about not getting sick. The greatest lie isn't told to others, but to himself, that he can control this, that it isn't really a problem because he's still functioning. High-functioning addiction allows denial to flourish because external markers suggest everything is fine. The exhausting performance required to maintain the illusion makes it perhaps more dangerous than obvious dysfunction. It permits the problem to deepen while everyone, including the addict, remains convinced things aren't that bad. After years cycling between addiction and ineffective treatment, David discovers buprenorphine, and everything changes. The medication stabilizes both his cravings and the underlying depression that drove him to heroin. Buprenorphine didn't just save my life, it gave me a life, he writes. With his brain chemistry balanced, he can finally engage meaningfully in therapy, developing psychological tools impossible while battling constant cravings. This transformation exposes traditional recovery's fatal flaw, treating addiction separately from co-occurring mental health conditions. The 12-step model's resistance to medication-assisted treatment endangers lives, especially for those self-medicating untreated conditions. David's journey demonstrates how evidence-based approaches succeed where rigid ideology fails. The memoir becomes advocacy, challenging stigma that prevents access to life-saving medications. Recovery isn't returning to who you were before drugs, it's becoming who you might have been if depression and addiction hadn't derailed your path. David redefines success not by sobriety days, but by quality of life, genuine connection, and community contribution, a holistic vision that accommodates diverse healing paths and rejects the binary thinking that dominated his early attempts. In a culture treating addiction as moral failure rather than medical condition, we continue losing lives that could be saved. David's story reveals a simple truth. Medication-assisted treatment, combined with mental health support and genuine human connection, accomplishes what shame, force, and abstinence-only approaches can't. Recovery means embracing medication and the freedom it provides. Freedom to be present for family, to create, to address depression, to live without constant cravings. It transforms relationships from deceptions upheld into cherished connections honored. Your struggle isn't moral failing. Your need for relief isn't weakness. Your path to healing doesn't have to follow someone else's script. The most radical act is choosing evidence over ideology, compassion over judgment, and your own integrated wholeness over anyone else's definition of recovery. The air you breathe can become lighter, not through force or shame, but through honest treatment that honors your full humanity.